What's in the president's proposed budget and what are the many ways in which it affects Texans? We'll tell you more next on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Maintenance for the wall in the years to come. Who'll be paying for that? Did you know California banned state-funded travel to Texas? Well, Texas is fighting back. What that means for children in state care. Machines that discriminate, can algorithms be less biased? How well do you know your Civil War history? And why are we still confused about the differences between hemp and marijuana? Stay tuned. You might learn a thing or two when The Standard begins, right after this. Greetings to every corner of the state from right here in the heart of Texas. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown on this February the 11th. We're so glad you're spending part of your Tuesday with us. As the eyes of the nation are focused on New Hampshire voters and the eyes of the world are focused on the coronavirus, here in Texas, we will focus our attention on the president's new proposed budget for obvious reasons. A federal budget hits home. And there's a lot to unpack for Texans. President Donald Trump's new multi-trillion dollar proposed budget released yesterday includes billions of more dollars building a U.S.-Mexico border wall. And that has Texas written all over it. That same federal budget also has proposed changes to the way the federal government reimburses for Medicaid. That also has Texas written all over it. To be clear, the administration's budget is a proposal that still needs Congress's approval. Now let's jump right into the numbers. First, looking at border spending because it raises the question of the role border spending will also play ahead of the 2020 election. Nick Miroff is an immigration reporter for The Washington Post, and he joins us now. Nick, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, good to be with you.
Nick, so what exactly in terms of border spending and immigration spending is the president proposing in this budget?
Well, there was something very interesting about this year's border wall funding request. The Trump administration has been asking Congress for $5 billion in construction funds each year. This year, they dropped that to $2 billion. Okay. A lot of people saw that and thought that that indicated that they were backing off in some way, but it actually means the opposite. The Trump administration is planning to take $7.2 billion from the Defense Department budget this year. So what we're seeing is a switch from asking Congress to fund the wall to simply taking the money the way that the administration prefers to do it.
One thing that I thought was very fascinating is that when you are writing about this border wall, you know, it's one thing to pay for the wall. It's another thing to pay for maintenance for the wall. And since you've looked into that, could you please talk to us a little bit about the maintenance of the wall?
Yeah, you know, this is actually something that has been surprisingly absent from the very intense debate over this project. Basically, you know, this is a border wall system, as the administration likes to point out, and that involves roads and sensors and lighting and all of these things that cost a great deal of money. So the reality is that the U.S. taxpayers are likely to be on the hook for billions of dollars over time in maintenance costs on this thing. The administration hasn't said what it projects, you know, what the cost liabilities are likely to be in the coming decades. But one of the big differences about this project, as opposed to, say, an infrastructure project like a port or an airport or highways, is that this is a project that lacks bipartisan support. You know, most infrastructure projects are popular and both parties are willing to spend money to keep things in top shape.
But they also pay for themselves.
This is almost entirely funded by one party.
I'm so sorry for interrupting you, but those projects that you were talking about, they also pay for themselves in tolls or in passenger fees or whatever. How do you pay for a system of walls that the government has to pay for it? And when you were saying we are in for billions of dollars, it's also we're in forever, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think It's a real question as, you know, as to whether a Democratic administration in the future is going to be willing to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on maintaining the structure that will be very much associated with the Trump presidency, you know, in the coming decades.
Now, when you were talking about the fact that the president requested less money and is going to divert funds from other sources, you know, the $2 billion that he's requesting, the last time he asked for money, it led to a gridlock. It led to a government shutdown. Is that likely to happen again?
No, I don't think so. You know, last time he asked for $5 billion, the Democrats gave him $1.4 billion, and then he went and took $6 billion, more than $6 billion from the Defense Department budget. And so this year, I think everyone has essentially decided to avoid that standoff again. The administration is going to ask for less money, probably get less than it asks for, but then it's just going to dip into the Pentagon accounts once again and take the money that it wants. Money, I should point out, that will pay for construction in the years to come. I mean, they already have the money they need to complete what the president has promised this year, a little bit more than 500 miles by the end of 2020. But the money that they're planning to take from the Pentagon budget this year will give them, they say, more than enough money to build more than 900 miles of new barriers along the border.
And is that construction on schedule?
No, that construction is very much behind. And your listeners in Texas will be familiar with this, but you know, building in Texas along the Rio Grande is proving to be very slow and difficult for the administration. And so what we're seeing is the pace of construction has quickened out west, where it's mostly federal land that the government controls. But in Texas, where almost all of the land is in private hands along the river, it's been very slow going. And I think it's highly unlikely that the administration will build the 150 or so miles it's planning to build along the river this year.
Nick Miroff reports for The Washington Post, and we'll link to his story. Please check out TexasStandard.org. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Joy. Good to be with you.
You may have heard Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton wrote to the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday asking that the court ends a ban California imposed on its state agencies to pay for travel to Texas. It all started in 2016. California lawmakers passed a law barring tax-funded travel to states with discriminatory laws. Fast forward to 2017, Texas passed a law that allowed foster care agencies to refuse services to children and parents based on, quote, sincerely held religious beliefs, end of quote. And some see this as a way to discriminate against the LGBT community. So Texas landed on California's list of states with discriminatory laws. Emma Platoff has been covering this story for the Texas Tribune. Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Emma, please remind us about this law that Texas lawmakers passed in 2017.
So this is, as you said, a 2017 law by State Representative James Frank, who's a Republican from Wichita Falls. And essentially, it allows faith-based organizations to deny certain services for contraceptives and also to deny adoption placements based on sincerely held religious beliefs. So advocates for this bill said this is, you know, an important measure for child welfare. And opponents, many of them advocates, or members of the LGBTQ community, said this is a way to sort of sanction discrimination, to make it legal for religious adoption agencies to discriminate against gay couples who may be looking to adopt in the state of Texas.
And when you look at it, you know, you can understand the discomfort between the LGBT community and lawmakers in Texas, but then you add the factor of California. So what happens with California?
So California has its own law passed in 2016 that allows its Attorney General, Javier Becerra, to sort of designate states in the United States that have discriminatory laws. Currently, the list is up to 11, and Texas was one of the first to be added to the list back in June 2017. Mm. And it says basically that we don't agree with what you've done with this policy, and we're not going to sort of provide you the economic boost that comes from state-funded travel for conferences, from state agencies. There are some implications for public universities. And we're not going to spend California taxpayers' dime to send people to states where we think the infrastructure of the laws is discriminatory.
So if I understand this correctly, if a professor at a state university in California wants to come to the University of Texas to do a presentation, that travel will not be covered.
Some universities have found kind of ways around this. I think the biggest hits have been on conferences, like academic conferences, but sports teams have sort of found ways to find other funding sources to get through. But certainly there have been some impacts in the academic community, yes.
And now the Attorney General Ken Paxton in Texas is saying, you know, California, what gives you the right to police other states?
Yeah, exactly. He's basically saying that this California law is both unconstitutional and misguided, and he's identified it as an attack on Texas's religious liberty. So he took that issue straight to the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday and said, you know, you're the right court to take up this issue and to tell California that what it's doing is wrong.
And I was curious when you mentioned that Texas is on the list and other states. So who else is in this list?
One of them is Oklahoma, which actually last month retaliated against California, saying, well, if you're going to bar state travel to Oklahoma, we're going to bar state travel back to California.
Oh,
and
God.
This is one of the things that Ken Paxton pointed to in his brief and kind of said, look at the impacts this is having. Clearly, we need the high court to step in.
Emma Platoff has been covering this story for the Texas Tribune. Emma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Wells Dunbar is here. He's social media editor, and he monitors the talk of Texas.
I sure do, Joy. Hi.
How are you?
Good. Good to be with you this Tuesday. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about the story we've been discussing so far in the show. That goes for the story we just heard.
Yeah.
How Texas is asking the Supreme Court of the United States to end California's taxpayer-funded travel ban to Texas. Mm-hmm. Just got into that with...
It's juicy.
Yeah. Interesting one there for sure. Lots of reactions bearing that out, Joy, coming in on our Facebook page. There, John E. Davis describes the situation thusly. Texas exercises states' rights by allowing for discrimination in the foster care system. California exercises states' rights in response. Texas goes to the federal courts to block a state's rights. Our writer there, John Davis, goes on to say that Attorney General Ken Paxton and Texas continue to want to have their cake and eat it too. And Paul Kiefer Jr. writes, if you can absolutely prove that California state-funded travel to Texas is a religious right, and I seriously doubt it, knock yourself out. Otherwise, zip it. You don't want California and other states meddling in your business, so don't go meddling in theirs. Lots of similar comments like that on the Facebook page.
Oh, you have
there
more.
Well, not for maybe some that aren't suitable for sharing right
okay.
now, but plenty more reactions there. You know, Joy, the only thing that's missing are those reactions from our friends and listeners out
yes,
there. So I would
encourage
them,
everybody.
Yeah, go
find
check
us on
it out.
Facebook, join us on Twitter, write to us, texasstandard@kut.org, or send us snail mail, 300 West Dean Keaton, Austin, Texas,
nice.
78712.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Business on Your Money on the Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. CBD stores have been popping up all over Texas since the state legalized hemp last year, but there's still confusion about the difference between hemp and marijuana because the latter remains illegal. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin looked into what the new law has brought.
As you drive through Houston, you may have noticed new stores that offer oils, creams, and other products that contain CBD. CBD is short for cannabidiol, a substance that's derived from both marijuana and hemp plants. I went to Webster to meet up with Gary Utzi. He's the general manager of a group of stores called Healing Leaf CBD.
We started out with one. We now will have five with our newest coffee store.
He says CBD has for a while been used to treat epilepsy, but he says it can help with a range of other ailments.
Anxiety, stress, PTSD, which we see a lot of... inflammation, arthritis, joint pain naturally. Those are the benefits you're going to see off the top for everybody.
Last year, the state legislature passed a law that legalizes the commercial production and sale of hemp in Texas. That followed on the footsteps of the Federal Farm Bill of 2018 that authorized states to do so. Catherine Harris is a drug policy expert at Rice University. She says before Texas passed a law, those selling CBD were acting in a gray zone.
There are a couple places actually where law enforcement kind of did try to make arrests for selling CBD products. You didn't see that in a lot of the larger urban areas, but that was something that ostensibly they could do.
Hemp is in the same family as marijuana. The main difference is that hemp contains close to no THC, the psychoactive substance that gets marijuana users high. Sam Adamo Jr. is an attorney with Adamo & Adamo in Houston and specializes in drug and cannabis law. He's glad Texas legalized hemp.
However, they put the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Before the law changed, determining a violation was like a pregnancy test. It either was or wasn't cannabis. Now it's more complicated.
When all of a sudden the flower became legal, law enforcement had no real way of knowing whether that was marijuana or whether that was now legal hemp.
That's led to several cases where people were arrested for marijuana possession, even though they were found with hemp. And on the other side of the coin, many Texas district attorneys have dropped marijuana cases, knowing that they can't prove the crime. But there's another issue. When you buy a CBD product, do you know what you're getting? Again, Catherine Harris.
Most of them are not tested, and there's not a lot of quality testing done for these products. So in the sense, you could say that some are kind of like snake oil.
Healing Leaf manager Utsi says their products are tested by a third party. He says there is no guarantee that CBD will work for someone, but
we guarantee you're seeing the level of cannabinoids, and they're listed out on each certificate showing exactly the levels that are in it.
Since there isn't much established science on the effectiveness of CBD, Harris advises consumers to do their own research before buying and try out different products to see what works best for them. So will the CBD wave continue or will it fade? Barbara Stewart is a retail expert at the University of Houston.
It may be that many of these are successful. It may be that they're short-term businesses that can get in and ride the wave of current popularity and current interest, and then they'll be on to some other product.
For now, there are more developments underway. Sam Houston State University is currently developing THC testing equipment for use by Texas crime labs. In Houston, I'm Florian Martin for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. We've been reporting on the Standard on the shortage of healthcare options for people in rural parts of the state, where hospitals and care providers have been closing their doors, and now those communities may soon be dealt another blow because of proposed Medicaid changes that could force some hospitals to cut services or shut down altogether. And here to tell us more is Gwendolyn Wu. She's been following the story for the Houston Chronicle, and she's also a Hearst Fellow for the Business Desk. Gwendolyn, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
It's an aggressive move because it would potentially cut $11 billion in funding in Texas. And I wonder, what's the goal?
Right. So what the administration is hoping to do here, they've said that the plan is to increase transparency, especially when it comes to data reporting from states to the federal level about how taxpayer money is spent. The kind of fine print when it comes to this, though, is that it seems to redefine what public funds are when it comes to Texas hospitals. Public funds can no longer be a mix of miscellaneous revenue, lease revenue, grant revenue, and state and local district funds. Instead, they're saying it has to be state and local funds only that make up public funds now.
But one thing that I'm curious about is the transparency aspect. What does that have to do with transparency? I mean, is there $11 billion of secrecy here?
We're not quite sure yet. So far, from the hospitals and healthcare organizations I've spoken to, it seems like there's been no analysis of the rules released the same way it would have been in the past. Because of that, a lot of these healthcare organizations have had to kind of go statute line by line to figure out what the actual changes in financial impact would be to their organizations.
Okay. I am assuming that the hospitals are pushing back and they're going to push back hard. What are they saying now?
Right. So last I heard, over 4,000 healthcare organizations had written letters to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare saying that they are not in favor of doing something like this. The American Hospital Association has said that they would prefer if the law just did not go into effect, period. They have a lot of concerns about the clarity of the language asking for data reporting requirements. Plus, honestly, they think that a rule like this isn't necessary because states have already been pushing for transparency. Some of the other organizations I spoke to, though, said that they don't have a problem with requesting more transparency, especially here in Texas, where they say they've already been pushing for it. So what they want to see is that the definitions of public funds would be changed to what is currently the status quo.
And the challenge for the general public really is that whatever happens in these megaspheres, it really affects a person. And forgive me for saying personally. So, you know, what are you to do if you are in a rural community and your hospital is, these rules go forward and your hospital is greatly affected or it ultimately closes?
Absolutely. The Texas Organization for Rural and Community Hospitals told me that they found that 46% of the state's rural hospitals operate at a loss.
Wow.
That's a pretty big number. And if some of the funding is cut away, they're estimating this might mean about $900 million a year in funding for them. We could see more closures. The kind of problem that we're starting to see, though, is that because there's no deadline to implement this rule, honestly, this change could come whenever. It could come as is. Last I spoke to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, they said that they don't have a planned estimate for when this rule would be rolled out, or they don't know if there might be other changes from the feedback they've gotten from those 4,000 healthcare organizations when it comes to making sure that this rule is kind of more in favor of what those healthcare organizations are hoping to see.
And just to remind the public that Medicaid is the health insurance for people who are low income. So where do we go from here, Gwendolyn?
Right now, we're kind of waiting in limbo. None of the healthcare organizations I spoke to have any sense of when a rule like this would be implemented. So they're just kind of holding with bated breath now that some of the feedback they've sent in those letters would be taken into account by the Trump administration.
Gwendolyn Wu is a Hearst Fellow at the Houston Chronicle. Gwendolyn, thank you so much for speaking with the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas is significantly underfunding students at historically black colleges and universities compared to the state's two flagship institutions of higher education. That's according to a new study from the left-leaning Center for Public Policy Priorities. It finds in 2018 the average per student state investment for HBCUs, Texas Southern University, and Prairie View A&M University was nearly $2,500 less than what went to the students at University of Texas and Texas A&M. Ashley Williams is the study's author.
Comparatively, the student bodies at HBCUs, our public HBCUs examined in the study, have much more financial need, yet the students are receiving a lot less per student support.
Williams explains more than 60% of students at the HBCUs had financial needs compared to about 23% at flagship Texas institutions. Meanwhile, state lawmakers meet later this morning to discuss rolling out new laws passed by the legislature for colleges and universities across Texas. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
The Texas House Higher Education Committee will be looking at how colleges and universities are carrying out some of the rules passed during the 2019 legislative session, including several involving sexual harassment, sexual assault, dating violence, and stalking on campus. Lawmakers also plan to examine if any changes need to be made to current laws because of rules and regulations on the federal level. The committee will also hear testimony on Senate Bill 38, which is meant to ensure colleges and universities disclose hazing incidents on campus.
That's Sasha Cordner reporting. Surrogates for Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren are on a five-city tour across Texas this week. The Democrats' presidential campaign is targeting Hispanic communities along the border and Gulf Coast. The tour kicked off in San Antonio last night, where civil rights activist Rosie Castro said the Latino community supports many of Warren's policies.
For example, the non-criminalization of immigration, all her financial plans, the wealth tax, the health care plans, her plans dealing with child care, education, and being able to do away with debt.
Castro is the mother of Congressman Joaquin Castro and former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro, who dropped his bid for the White House last month. And spring has sprung for many Texas Rangers fans as team pitchers and catchers report for spring training today in Arizona. Houston Astros pitchers and catchers report tomorrow in Florida. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
It's 33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. When you apply for that next new job, you may need to do more than impress a hiring manager because you might first be judged by an algorithm. It's software that uses artificial intelligence to evaluate not just your qualifications, but perhaps your facial expressions, the tone of your voice. Alexandra Givens wrote about it for Slate. Her article touches on the ways software-based hiring can affect people who may not look or sound the way algorithms think new hires should look or sound. She's executive director of Georgetown Law School's Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, and the vice chair of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. She spoke with host David Brown.
This AI-based hiring software has been criticized for apparent bias against women, people with darker skin tones, but apparently another group of job seekers also faced AI discrimination. A quarter of adults living with a disability, is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you think about how these tools are trained, a lot of them look at models for existing successful employees in the workforce, and they train the tools to represent and replicate what those employees are doing. But the problem is people with disabilities are hugely underrepresented in the workforce for a whole host of reasons going back for centuries. And so what we're really worried about is that the tools are going to perpetuate that existing discrimination and make it even worse.
Let's talk a little bit about how this works, because there are plenty of people who have not experienced a software-based. How does AI play a role in making a hiring decision?
So there are a couple different ways that these tools are being used. One is what you're alluding to before. So instead of having an in-person interview, right, the thing that we're used to where you get dressed up and go and talk with a hiring manager, they'll record a video with you where you're answering questions into the video screen. And then there's some companies that purport to do AI analysis on that video. And what they're doing is analyzing your tone of voice, your facial movements, as well as the language that you use in your response. And they're comparing that to the sample set that they've trained their tool on.
How is it that people with disabilities might be narrowed or singled out here? I mean, what is it? Is it that different, what, facial features or what is it? How does that work?
Right, all of the above, right? Just think about it for a moment. If one of the things that they're measuring is your facial movement as a way perhaps of seeing how frequently you smile during a conversation, you could think about people with facial paralysis. You know, their facial movements don't look the same as some others in the training data. But you also can think about people who are blind, so they're not making eye contact with the camera in a particular way. Mm-hmm. Or autistic people, right, who may just look different and have their face move in a different way when they speak. And again, those were all just superficial qualities that shouldn't actually be going to whether or not somebody can do the job in question.
Is there a way around this? I mean, is there a way to teach AI to be more accommodative? I would imagine that there would be.
So there are some, but I actually feel really worried about those promises. A lot of the vendors right now are actually saying that they're auditing their tools for bias, and therefore we don't have to worry about it. But it actually is much more complicated than that when you think about disability. There are so many different types of disabilities. And even, say, for example, if someone has visual impairment, it actually affects people in very different ways. So the idea that you can train a model to accommodate all of these different forms of disability is really hard, not least because we don't really have that training data. And often people don't want to disclose their disabilities to help shape and train tools like this. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, though, if given that AI does what we program it to do, isn't it possible that we can just do a better job of developing the software? That is, in fact, maybe job seekers with disabilities might actually be able to benefit from being evaluated based on their skills alone rather than, you know, appearance biases and that sort of thing.
So that's part of it, but it can't be the whole answer. Yes, there are ways in which technology is transforming the workplace and that these tests are trying to get people, as you say, on their skills, not on stereotypes about them or assumptions based on race or gender or these other classes. But the problem is, because there are so many different forms of disability and because we don't have kind of this existing representation in the workforce that the AI tools can learn from, creating any tool that accommodates people is really complicated, which means we need to have a thoughtful conversation with disabled people at the table, actually testing what these tools are looking at and how they're being used. And right now that's getting glossed over by many of the vendors. So what we're calling for in my project at Georgetown is for people to be a lot more thoughtful about this in the design phase, but then also be much more thoughtful on the testing and auditing side of the spectrum, so that even once the tools are used, we can keep testing them to make sure that they're as fair as possible.
Alexandra Givens directs the Georgetown Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. Her father is the late actor and activist, Christopher Reeve. Ms. Givens, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at TexasOncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. There is a weight of history attached to place names like Gettysburg, Shiloh, and Antietam. But for those who know American history, they conjure images and emotions in a way that perhaps places like Valverde, Glorieta Pass, and Mesilla do not. But those names have something in common. They're all Civil War battle sites. The difference is that the latter three took place in the West. The war's Western theater seldom gets as much attention as those battles in the East, but historian Megan Kate Nelson would like to change that a bit with a new perspective on America's bloodiest conflict. Her book is The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. Dr. Nelson spoke with host David Brown.
This story takes place a long way from the central theater of the Civil War, as so many of us learned about it back in school. So why was control of the Southwest considered so important by both the Union and the Confederacy?
Well, it was important before the war, and then it continued to be important during the war. And for the Confederacy, they really wanted access, particularly to California. They wanted access to gold mines so they could fund their war effort. And they wanted access to the Pacific ports of California because they needed to be able to export their cotton. And already in the first summer of the war, the Union was becoming quite successful at blockading their ports along the Gulf and the Southeast. And so for the Confederacy, this was a place, and all the area kind of west of Texas was a corridor through which they could march and hopefully seize that territory and really be able to fuel the rest of their campaign against the Union.
And what about the Union? Why did the Union consider this area so important?
Well, they also wanted to keep control of the gold mines and the Pacific ports.
Makes sense.
For them, it was most important that they keep the West out of Confederate hands, because if the Confederacy was successful in taking what was New Mexico territory at the time, they would be able to not only access California, but they could launch campaigns for the greater West. And then the Union would be hemmed in on all sides by the Confederacy.
You start this story with a Texan named John Baylor. Tell us a little bit about him, who he was, and why did you decide to begin with him?
Sure, yeah. So Baylor was not born in Texas. He was actually born in Kentucky. But he came to Texas when he was a teenager. He came to live with one of his uncles, William Baylor. And in fact, another of his uncles, Robert Baylor, is the co-founder of Baylor University. Mm-hmm. So it is that family. And Baylor is just one of those guys who you can't quite believe existed during this time. Because he seems so extraordinary, and yet he, I think, was also quite typical in that he was really a jack of all trades. He was initially a farmer, then he got himself elected to the Texas State Legislature, then he read the law, became a lawyer, he was appointed an Indian agent. He was one of these people in the 1850s who saw West Texas mm-hmm. and said, aha, this is ranching country. Mm-hmm. He was a slave owner. And he also became an Indian hater, and he went out with the Texas Rangers multiple times in raids against Comanches in western and northwestern Texas. So by the time the Civil War rolled around, he was sort of primed and ready to advocate for the Confederacy, and he volunteered for the Army, and he had recruited more than 300 men. He'd just mm-hmm. been riding around. He was, by all accounts, a very magnetic character, and he argued very persuasively among his fellow kind of frontier Texans that they should join the Confederacy and fight with him in what he called a buffalo hunt. And so he ended up in San Antonio in the summer of 1861, and he was given command of the 2nd Texas Mounted Rifles and sent west to make his way to El Paso and Fort Bliss.
But I think we should bring in the third corner here, because not much has been discussed about Native Americans and their involvement in mm-hmm. the Civil War. You know, you think about how many Indians were marched westward under President Jackson, and I would imagine mm-hmm. that in some sense, at least, the Confederacy and joining or being sympathetic to the Confederacy would have been seen as an opportunity to get back at the United States, which mm-hmm. forced so many of these tribes to leave their lands.
Oh, certainly. And there were several tribes in Indian Territory, which, of course, is on Texas' northern border, who did throw in with the Confederacy, who did fight for them for that very reason, and because those particular groups were slave owning. So they found common cause with the Confederacy. The tribes of the Southwest, Comanches and Apaches and Navajos in particular, had a more complicated relationship both with the federal government and then also with the Confederates when they arrived. Mostly, these groups saw what, you know, they termed the white man's war as an opportunity, because here, for the first time, there were these long wagon trains mm-hmm. and these huge beef herds of 3,000 cattle and abundant mules and horses. And for Native communities in the Southwest, those animals, particularly mules and horses, were the kind of backbone of their trade in the region. And so they started pretty much immediately raiding both Union and Confederate wagon trains and siphoning off animals. Every now and again, they would make sort of verbal treaties with either Union troops or Confederate troops. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Other times they raided them. Other times they attacked their forts because in their view, these were foreign entities marching large armies through their territory. Part of my argument in the Three-Cornered War is that this was a moment that actually launched the Indian Wars of the 1870s.
Interesting.
So that yeah. the Civil War was, in fact, an Indian War, because once the Union troops kind of got rid of the Confederate Texans and sent them back to San Antonio in the summer of 1862, they really turned their attention to particularly the Chiricahua Apaches of southern New Mexico and Arizona, and then the Navajo people.
Dr. Nelson, what made you interested in revisiting this particular chapter of history? I mean, one obvious thought that occurs to me is that really people haven't talked about the Civil War as more than North versus South, at least, the, you know, in popular culture.
Exactly. Yeah, that was part of my interest. I wrote a book about the Civil War before this and focused mostly on the Southeastern Theater. And as I was researching that book, I sort of discovered that there were these conflicts in New Mexico territory. And I was amazed because I grew up in Colorado. And there were Colorado soldiers who fought in these conflicts against Baylor and his Texans. And I had never heard of that. And so I was interested not only in what had happened, but also why it has been erased in American memory. Because if you look at any Civil War textbook now or any kind of broader Civil War text, if you look at the map of the war, it actually ends, its western border is in central Texas. So half that's Confederate state has been cut off. And so I think it convinces Americans that, well, you know, if it's not on the map, could anything really have happened there that was important?
But it was indeed an important theater and one with many stories to tell. Megan Kate Nelson tells them as author and historian in a new book, The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. Dr. Nelson, thanks so much for spending a little time with us on the Texas Standard. I wish we had more time. It's a really interesting book.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The number of gun deaths, not including suicides, are about 1,000 a year in Texas, and that number has been relatively flat between 2008 and 2017. Nationally, many American cities report that gun homicides are on the decline, but Durham, North Carolina saw its homicides rise in 2019, leaving residents to cope with what they feel is chronic violence. As Guns and America's Aditi Bandlamudi reports, the new year has provided the community a chance to reflect and recommit to the future.
Let us pray. O Lord, our God,
many in Durham are still raw from a particularly violent year. The shooting death of a 9-year-old boy back in August hit the community especially hard. But it was just one of 37 homicides in Durham last year, a 20% increase from 2018.
We have to stick together, be together, love one another.
Keisha Gray is speaking at a vigil to honor all 37 lives at the Southside Church of Christ.
This is not normal. Normal is growing old.
The majority of the violence has been happening in areas east and south of downtown Durham. It's more densely populated and removed from the wealthier parts of town. It's here that Gray and her coworker David Johnson have gathered a few dozen people on a cloudy and cold Monday evening to remember those they've lost and to share their stories.
We're losing everybody, not only to death, but to the penitentiary.
Both Gray and Johnson work for Bull City United, a community outreach program run through Durham County's Department of Public Health. Johnson is what's called a violence interrupter.
Like, just say I'm in the community and something transpires and an individual wants to go out and commit a violent crime. I would actually sit down with him and let him know, like, the pros and cons of what his actions would lead to. Like, and 9 times out of 10, that helps people make better decisions.
Johnson grew up in this part of town and used to be in a gang, so he feels he's better able to establish a relationship with those in the community who might turn to violence.
We're people from those communities. We're people that people already know and trust, like that's going out trying to change our lives and also trying to change the lives of other people.
According to the county's Department of Public Health, the number of shootings in neighborhoods that work with Bull City United in Durham's East and South Side is down 28% over 2 years from when the program started in 2016. Johnson and his team target the few people who pick up a gun and plan to hurt someone with it. Thomas Apt, a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, says this is the right tactic.
We need to make sure that we provide these individuals with a balanced range of incentives to help them change their behavior.
And it's not just Durham. More than 25 cities across the country have adopted this method. Part of Johnson's mission is to help find employment for people who only turn to violence to get by. In most cities, the approach is effective, but Apt says it takes communities and cops.
I've been working in this field now for 20 years or so, and I'm not aware of any city that has simply arrested their way out of urban violence or simply programmed their way out of urban violence.
The violence not only contributes to loss of life, it leaves a lasting mark on the community, feeding the cycle of violence. Ernestine Briggs King is a psychologist in Durham and often sees patients dealing with PTSD and other symptoms of trauma.
So we see a lot of different responses that kids may have to keep their brothers and sisters safe. They may start carrying weapons. They may join a gang.
And she says worrying about how to keep themselves safe cuts into time they can spend learning, playing, and getting to be a kid. Violence interrupter David Johnson says his job can be brutal, especially when someone he works with gets arrested or shot. But that won't stop him.
So I never stop. The goal is, like, even if you don't hear me today, maybe you'll hear me tomorrow. Like, so that's always the goal. So we never stop. As a group, we never stop.
The vigil you heard earlier has become an unfortunate but cathartic annual tradition in Durham. It kicks off a year when Johnson says he will not only need to spend one-on-one time with those most at risk in Durham, but the community will have to come together to make a positive change. For Guns in America, I'm Aditi Bandlamudi.
Guns and America and our partner station KERA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. Find more at gunsandamerica.org. And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Well, Dunbar, where did time went?
Where does it go, Joy? Hey, I have a question.
Please.
Have you gotten any letters in the mail yet?
No, but you can write to us, 300 West Inkeaton, Austin, Texas, 78712.
Hey, you know, I tweeted about it. Enough of this digital ephemera. Come on, let's
That's
get
right.
some.
Well, the thing is, people want to communicate with us, and I just want to give them every opportunity.
You know, I love that. You know, exactly. Yep. We're a radio station, terrestrial radio. Let's not shun any form of communication there.
No.
Well, speaking of stories that folks are chiming in about, we're hearing about that story at the top of the show, President Trump's call for billions more dollars for border wall in his administration's new proposed budget. And as we heard from our guest, the Washington Post's Nick Miroff, none of that includes maintenance costs.
No, and the thing is, it's a very big wall.
Yeah, definitely so. And, you know, this is sort of the first thing that came to my mind via an allusion to this news event from Martha Humphreys on her Facebook page. She asked, how much to put it back up every time a strong breeze blows it down?
Ooh, she's referring... talking to California?
Yeah, she was referring to that. Yeah, this portion of a new wall in California that fell over and actually tipped over onto the Mexico side.
Yes. What do you do then?
Well, I think cooler heads prevail.
Well, Mexico is paying for it, I guess.
Well, in one way or another. But yeah, very fascinating. That was just a strange incident. And really highlighting the sort of unforeseen costs associated with such a thing.
I agree with you.
Definitely so.
The thing is, when you build something, you know, I know the president likes to say it's a big, beautiful wall, but construction does not stay beautiful forever.
No. As any homeowner knows, yes, I was going to say. I
Dear
went
God.
There. Well, in other news, a little bit of a sad story here.
Oh,
the
well.
Booming voice of Big Techs.
You were going to talk about
famous
that.
Pitchman for the State Fair of Texas there in Dallas. 55-foot tall icon. Well, he's going to sound a little different from now on since the voice of Big Tech, the one Robert Bob Boykin, has died.
Yeah.
Boykin was the voice of Big Tech for the past 7 years there. Lots of people chiming in about this online. Really nice
what
remembrance.
Are they saying?
Really lovely remembrance here via Twitter from one Bill Baker. He says, on January 23rd, the voice of Big Tech, Bob Boykin, passed away. And I should interject here that he did pass away some time ago, but we're just recently learning about it.
Right.
We have lost an icon, and his wife has lost a husband. So thank you for sharing, Bob, with all of those who have attended the State Fair of Texas in the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice sentiment there. And a reminder that, so many voices that touch us. We're familiar with what they bring to our lives, but not to the sort of private lives that they leave behind there. Another quick thing to look for, New Hampshire happening tonight. Lots of folks looking out for Joe Biden and how he may do, whether this could sort of be his last stand, so to speak. We caught up with Joe Biden last week, I believe, on the program. Mm-hmm. Lots of folks chiming in about that on our Facebook page as well there. Just search for Texas Standard on the trusty Facebook search icon.
We have an interview with Andrew Yang, and we're reaching out to all the other Democratic presidential candidates. So if they want to come on the show, the doors are welcome. Open. Welcome. Well, that too. Please reach us out on Facebook, on Twitter, on behalf of David Brown and the rest of the team. I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.